Welcome to AI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined today by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI, who has written an essay which has attracted quite a lot of attention about attention spans, distraction in our smartphone-mediated world. Is the attention span in decline? Is it unaffected, as some recent studies suggest, by mobile phones and computer screens? Alistair's here. Now, why did you write this essay, Alistair? It seems quite an urgent essay.
It has sort of banal roots. I've been on public transport a lot in the last month, going up and down the country, and that gives you a bit of time to observe the rest of the public and what they do when they're in public. At least on three occasions, I was marooned in that terrible situation where people are playing music off their phones in an enclosed space with you there, and you're
not
just
good.
Yeah, it's just one of these weird norms of modern life that people seem to have now, that they don't seem to realise that other people are there too and can hear what they're doing. Mm. And actually, the more I thought about this, the more I began to think of it as a kind of explanation for a lot of other problems that we have. This issue of attention, its scarcity, and also its just centrality to a lot of the problems we have, whether it's discussions about working from home, foreign policy, what we do with our social and political settlements. Mm. All these things are integrated in this theme of what are we looking at, what are we focusing on, and what are we paying attention to. So I began the essay with a little picture, which is played out over and over again. This kind of set of movements is played out over and over again throughout the world. On every street corner, in every pub, in every cafe, in every train, in every hospital, in every single place and part of the world where it's public, this set of movements happens. So I'm going to illustrate that with a little case study. Mm. So imagine you're sitting in an empty train carriage. You're sitting in an empty train carriage. And so our notional person is sitting in an empty train carriage and you're looking out of the window. Your eyes are flitting backwards and forwards, pylon to pylon. And sometimes, we've all been there, you focus on a particular tree, you see its axis turn with the motion of the train, and you think, God, this is a pleasant sensation. You know, this little moment of mind and matter, technology, high technology, the train is such a recent invention, everything whizzing by, and you're there at the centre of it all, just observing, aware. Then your phone buzzes, this thing that's clutched in our hands or our pockets, and suddenly you're flushed with urgency, expectation, what's happening. You grapple, you prod, you open it up. And suddenly you're completely absorbed in it. There's 10 things you haven't looked at. You know, there's a WhatsApp video from your mate that you just need to watch. And suddenly the landscape's gone. Mm. It's just disappeared from human attention. It might as well not even exist anymore. And few people actually make it as far as this traveller, who's actually registering the scene for a bit before he's sort of pulled back into his phone. And it's just this funny, curious set of movements. You're sitting before a concert, anywhere where there is nothing to do, people stare into space. They're suddenly conscious of a kind of blankness, of a kind of interior blankness. There's a kind of glazed expression that flits across these people's faces. And then suddenly the phone is out.
And you find yourself doing this.
Of course. I'm no different. And suddenly you're completely a picture of concentration.
So it's like the opposite of raw dogging.
Yeah, well, raw dogging, a term that Paul has introduced to the office because he seems to have discovered it recently.
I'm very hip.
But again, once I started thinking about this, I did a little bit of an experiment and walked down the road and looked at how often people are doing this. And again, it sounds very boring and banal, but suddenly you realise, God, everyone is doing this all the time. Mm. It's like the main thing people do.
No, and it's a real worry. I mean, I do think particularly post-lockdown, that we entered into a very, very curious world of distraction. In some ways, it was a period where concentration, I read an awful lot, listened to an awful lot of music, and so there was a concentration there. There wasn't much to do, but I definitely felt as though I was tempted to distraction once we re-emerged from that lockdown world.
Yeah. I think the last 5 years, in terms of the lockdown, which was a kind of case study of diffusing technology further to help us cope with the lockdown. So you saw that in education, is using screens to facilitate education. So it was a kind of case study of what happens when you make tech even more integrated with life. And yeah, that's potentially a kind of second order.
And you get the sense that there has been a reduction in attention span. Because not every study suggests that that's the case, that it may have just differed in terms of the way distraction is dealt with or attention spans are sustained.
Yeah. Well, it just depends what you mean by attention span.
Of course.
And I have seen a lot of evidence that the measures we have physiologically, the kind of neuro measures of human attention span, haven't been affected by tech in particular, even among children, where there is the most kind of cultural anxiety around the use of smartphones. I find it interesting that children always seem to be the focus of this anxiety when you look at adults who are just as marooned and actually far more responsibilities can't actually have the slack that children have.
I have exactly this argument, I think, also from the working from home debate, where it seems to me that younger people are desperate to go into an office and engage and have those kind of serendipities and contingencies that the office contains. Also important about working in office is you realise that not everyone's absolutely brilliant there, and it enables you to advance your own ambitions. So that interaction is important, of course, and that was the thing that was so lost during lockdown. And that interaction, in a way, sustains and develops concentration.
Yeah, and because it provides the emotional base for actually concentrating and holding attention. And that's what I wanted to focus on in my essay, that there is a whole argument within Western thought in particular, or that's just what I know about, but about attention that goes far beyond the platitudes that people often use. Be more present. That's what modern culture often says to us. Live in the moment. Be more present.
Yeah.
And that's something to do with the way mindfulness, which is a kind of fusion of quietist Western traditions and Eastern meditation techniques, has become basically a modern dogma. You've repurposed actually very helpful techniques, breathing techniques, mind's eye training, using the body and the breath to still the brain, that people have used forever. When you're seeing someone having a panic attack, what do you tell them to do? Control their breathing.
And as Chris Harding said, and I think Chris Harding would argue, friend of the show, Chris Harding, of course, expert on Japanese and other Asian cultures, he talks about ideas like mindfulness, wellness, actually having particular roots not just in Stoic philosophies of the ancients, but also in Indian culture in particular, but in South Asian and Southeast Asian culture more widely, and perhaps in a way misinterpreted, but also in a creative way when we think about things like yoga, when we think about mindfulness. Just because you misinterpret something or make a mistake about something, it can be quite creative, those misunderstandings.
Yeah. I always think about Carl Jung's introduction to a kind of book on Zen, where he talks about how the Western mind will not be cured by people doing an hour's yoga every day. It's
true.
The point is about these philosophies. What modern mindfulness tells us to be present is only really one aspect of these philosophies. So if you look at the kind of Greek Stoic tradition as it was transmitted into Roman thought, and that's where we get all our evidence for Stoicism through Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, this kind of being present, this kind of slightly quietist view that you shouldn't worry too much about the future, you shouldn't be overridden by anxieties about what is to come, you shouldn't overinvest in particular emotions that you're feeling at the moment, you should kind of be zen, as it were. It's only really one part. And they saw their philosophical frameworks as totally all-consuming. They had views on cosmology, they had views on materialism, they had strong ethical views about what virtue is constituted by, friendship. These are tougher, knottier questions than saying, say, for example, lay holes in the present. You know, do what you need to do today rather than tomorrow.
Yeah, what we have is very, very complex philosophies filtered by the likes of Alan Watts, I suppose.
Exactly. That has been commercialised. So I think what I was getting at with this idea of attention, this feeling that tech has changed our attention, I don't think so. I think modern culture has changed the way we think about attention and has narrowed our grasp on what real attention can be because of the commercialisation of mindfulness, its dissemination throughout society, how it's embraced everywhere in the faux profound language of the advertising world and the legacy media. So what was a perfectly simple set of meditation techniques which tell you, you know, be a bit more present, pay attention to your body, has become a bit of a pseudo-philosophy. And even in Stoicism, that's never seen as enough. You have to go into all kinds of ethical debates, which are a bit trickier and are a bit more about action in the world. Mm. They're kind of about what you do. And I think a lot of modern culture doesn't so much think about how you can prescribe what you can do. It's how you feel towards yourself. And it's great to feel better about yourself. It probably does help you to do more things, but it's not enough. You have to go further. Yeah. You have to cultivate knowledge. You have to change the way you relate to people. You have to think more holistically about what psychological, emotional, and physical health look like.
I think you also have to think about what this happiness, this wellness culture is, what is so attractive about that. For example, on BBC Radio 3, for an international audience, that's the BBC channel that's devoted largely to classical music and the higher cultures, or at least used to be, there's a lot of stuff about relax with classical music. You know, there's this kind of wellness philosophy there. I mean, really? Have you heard Wagner? Have you heard Bruckner? Have you heard Bach? I don't see this as being anything of what's attractive about, say, that particular art form or indeed the novel. Where I do think that technology has helped us recently, if we take it as read, that there has been some damage caused to attention spans, that they've been minimised in some way, that distraction has been promoted, I think technology does provide some answers. So, for example, noise-cancelling headphones. They are one of the great, great things of all time. And the rise of apps like Audible, which allow you to listen sustained to long, you know, 18th, 19th, 20th century novels that I've listened to over just recent months, the likes of Anna Karenina, Trollope, Dickens, and all kinds of stuff that I probably wouldn't have done, including the ancient stuff like Iliad, Odyssey, that I probably wouldn't have done before that, because I wouldn't have had that time or inclination to just sit down and read this stuff over and over again. And these are extended works, you know, Dostoevsky, this is George Eliot, Middlemarch, great reading of Middlemarch. This stuff that you have read before, that you've come across before, but really in a sustained way, and technology has enabled that. And I see that as a real counter to this distraction, this ability to want everything to be short, and just a means of a kind of passivity that's there in wellness rather than engagement with the work. And the very nature of a work that's regarded as a classic is that, A, you're probably not wasting your time. It's probably good. And even if you can't quite grasp that, you might persist with it because of its classic status. And I think, secondly, having that kind of engagement with something so complex, so rich, can only help the brain to reconnect itself to that kind of deep thought. And the other thing that I think, and this has less to do with technology, is just the one art form, apart from the classic novel that really does this, is classical music. And this is the weird thing about classical music form, is that it's being sold as, hey, relax to this Brahms slow movement or something, when in fact it is highly developed. It is often very long. It's very, very complex. To understand it, you might just like it in a superficial way because of a melody or the tone of that piece or the harmony that's there. But actually, if you're really going to understand it, you're going to have to stick with it again and again and again and work out those arguments, place works within the context of other works, understand that tradition, have the ability, and this is the great sadness of the loss of the marginalisation of Record Review on Radio 3 and building a library, is that you understand the difference between a good, a great, and a poor performance of these works as well. And I have to say, that is the one thing, I think, of anything I've ever come across, any art form, any cultural form, that has allowed me to sustain a developed engagement with a work of art. And if you can do that, it makes it so much easier to engage with other serious works of art as well.
And there's a profound social and political basis to this work as well, which that passivity doesn't grasp. And once you get into that, that is again another avenue for thinking about what art inspires and what it's done for people in terms of illuminating the situation at large. And I think that passivity, I get why neo-stoicism is very appealing to kind of tech tycoons and Silicon Valley people, because it fundamentally speaks to the interior world. How can I feel a bit better? They don't look at the stuff which says, how do I show compassion without becoming over emotional?
Yep.
That's a kind of key stoic thing, which is actually a really hard idea to grasp, especially for us who were so influenced by Christianity. Stoics were really against emotions like pity, but they thought you should still help people. So all these kinds of little debates that the Stoics were interested in, which were highly political at the time, are not reflected in the kind of modern trash philosophy of mindfulness. You know, it's actually highly political. It's about who you are in general. It's how you behave ethically to other people. And
I think the opposition to, say, classical music, which I think is profound now in the West, a real almost war, I would say, against classical music and whatever it stands for, is also politicized and cultural, because it is this idea of elitism, that people who can engage with this stuff, people who can engage seriously with 19th century novel, put in that hard work, and only a certain group of people can do this, which is a kind of nonsense. It may be true that only certain people can practice this stuff. I'll admit that I certainly couldn't do it. But to engage with it on a serious level should be open to as many people as possible. And classical music, and like any other art form, shouldn't be sold on this basis of passivity. It is engagement with a work of art. And that can be, and I think it, once you are involved in that engagement, that profound engagement, as one understands, it could be architecture, which is, you know, argued that it's music in stone or whatever. Once you have that kind of language, you pick up that kind of language, you can then engage with it. And the riches are incalculable in the development of a human being. It doesn't make you morally better, but it does make the world so much more rich in terms of engagement. But it can't be earned easily. You have to engage with this stuff. It is not something that you can just listen to for a little bit. You have to engage. In the most extreme example, I went through an entire Ring cycle again this summer. I can't think, you know, most people would balk at sitting through 14 and a half hours of Gesamtkunstwerk over a week, but I really can't think of anything that's more rewarding. And people who do endure, if that's the word, that come out with a profound, life-changing experience. And that's so true. That may be a Bruckner cycle, that might be a Bach passion, that might be listening to chamber music, whether a Beethoven string quartet or a Chopin nocturne. It's all there. These are profound. And also, this goes back to the classic novel. This goes back to Renaissance art, or the great painters, the great architects, that it's tried and tested. This has been tested over time, and it is great. People come up and down in that scale, but this stood the test of time. And so, big piece of advice I would do is don't really bother with the new stuff. Because we don't know. What are the chances that any of the novels that are released this year will be sustained? Some of them might be.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think the foundation of any good cultural education and cultural literacy is the classics, in every sense of that word.
And you can kind of grasp the new stuff pretty easily if you've got that kind of crenellated intelligence. You know, if you go and see, for example, Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, and people say, oh, it's 6 hours long. Well, what do you do all day? You sit on a computer. I mean, it's not that long in the grand scheme of things.
But
the point is, you're not always enjoying it moment to moment. It's not necessarily sensory overload. You get an effect that you reflect on in the days after, some quality of life, some fine quality of life that wasn't there before. And it's something you can develop, you can almost interrogate, you can say, well, what did that do for me? Why did that create that glimmer at the edge of your consciousness? Why did it do that to me?
Yeah.
And why do I want to tell people about it? And that's the next thing, is why do I want to explain what that was for me to you? And why do I want to bring people into that magic circle? And I think we often think that the first bit is enough, and we don't invest enough time in explaining it. And classical music, Paul, is a great example. We've got incredible musicians in this country, extraordinary tradition of people who've been through some of the finest schools of music in the world. And we have people from all over the world who come here to play music and are impressed by the infrastructure we have. But there's a kind of lack of that communication that binds people into that experience. And that seems to be the problem. It's not that we don't have this enormous amount of talent there. It's that we're not maybe thinking about how we can communicate what that means in a way that is not patronising, in a way that actually brings people into it and then lets them form their own impressions and then they go away. And I think, you know, there's that thing that you talk about on Radio 3, that kind of relax with this, yeah, or it's feel so this annoying. Way, or this will make you happier. People are not stupid. They pick up on that as a kind of patronising device to say, this is important for this reason. But actually, music can be important for many reasons. There's nothing to do with happiness, nothing to do with whether you feel relaxed or not. They can make you feel anxious. They can make you feel
absolutely.
They can make you feel things in a symbolic language, which are basically so personal. And there are very few people who can explain what that symbolic language does to them. But again, when did you last hear on Radio 3 someone actually talk in those terms, rather than a kind of, this will make you feel happy, sad, or whatever. Yeah. It's just...
I think it was when I was on Free Thinking talking about the essay, but maybe there's been others. But I don't think a mistake that could be made... We've talked about the 19th century novel, like Dostoevsky or Tolstoy or whatever. Mm. We've talked about those great works, Gesamtkunstwerk of Wagner, Bruckner Cycles. We shouldn't mistake the idea that length means profundity, because it's certainly always done. I can think of many, many works of great length that are incredibly tedious, incredibly just dull. And many of the really great works that demand their attention are short. I think in particular, you think of something like Shakespeare's sonnets, of which there are worlds within each of them. And it's relatively easy to memorize a Shakespeare sonnet, but to wholly engage with all the meaning that is present in it. I'm thinking particularly of Sonnet 44, If the Dull Substance of My Flesh Were Thought. An incredibly deep poem, as all of them are. Endless riches, endless to be thought over. I was thinking about works by Catullus, which I adore, which are very, very different. And the other mistake we shouldn't make is that because something is tragic, it is better than something that is comic. I think of, in this particular, as I'm a really great figure, is P.G. Wodehouse, who is a genuinely great writer in both form and content. And yet that lightness of touch makes us think, oh, well, you know, it's not as profound as something. It's, in a way, I think a lot of people think of Mozart symphonies or Haydn symphonies as not being as profound as, say, a Beethoven, or because there's a sort of lightness of touch. It's a complete nonsense. You know, they have to be judged within their own terms. Almost, and there is no shortage of that. As Bob Dylan said, you know, it takes a lot to laugh. It takes a train to cry.
It's almost, in almost every Mahler symphony, those great carapaces of violent emotion at times. There's often near comic moments, there's that lightness of touch. And actually, the lightness of touch moments in Mahler often prepare you emotionally for the bits which seem very portentous, which are about, you know, these grand themes, renewing the world, renewing our relationship with
and
nature.
And that's why it's difficult when we have this excerpt culture. We'll play you a slow movement. This will relax you in the morning. You know, you're up listening to the breakfast programme on Radio 3 and you're going to relax now. I mean, why you'd want to relax at 8 o'clock? I mean, you want something to surprise you. You know, maybe hide and surprise.
I want some panicky music.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what you want. But it is listening to those whole works, ultimately, when you see the way it develops, when you see the way the movements relate to one another, and indeed may relate to other works, whether by that composer or by others. Mahler, of course, famously quotes Brahms. You know, there is a kind of tradition that's there. And Shostakovich quotes Wagner, and it goes on like this. They see themselves as part of a tradition. To understand that tradition, you don't have to understand that tradition, but my goodness, you'll get a much, much greater sense of what's being achieved as one does. And this is also the other thing about distraction, is this engagement with great art is a lifelong journey. However many times you listen to a great work of music, however many times you look at a great painting, however many times you read out a great sonnet or memorize a great sonnet, there will be more there. There will always be more that you discover, because it's in that in which it can never be wholly comprehended by anyone that part of the magic is there, that part of the greatness is there.
I think that I chose to focus for quite a lot of the essay I wrote on attention on the French philosopher Michel de Montaigne, partly because I love Montaigne, and it just resonated there what you said about there always being more.
Yeah.
And I've spent years reading the Montaigne essays.
And this gives you a humility towards the work as
well. And sometimes I read just a short one. You know, some of them are just a page long. I mean, the whole, you know, the Penguin edition of Montaigne's essay is about 1,000 pages long.
Yeah. Yeah.
The best translation is the Screech translation. But sometimes I'll just have a bit of a bad day, and there's always you remember there's that little essay on sadness or feeling anxious, and you suddenly feel a little bit fuller. You feel a little bit that you're not quite as alone in your emotional landscape as you were before. There are the big essays he wrote, the kind of long, pretty philosophical treatise stuff, where he really goes into the weeds of scholastics and the kind of philosophical frameworks that are available to him. And I think Montaigne is a wonderful person to come back to, because it's a kind of secular morality. It's completely accessible for people who are not religious, because Montaigne was a deeply sceptical, agnostic person. I mean, he was Catholic, but he was basically a sceptic.
And owed a lot to the classical world.
Of course. It's peppers with his reading. And he's also the first to say, you know, he said, if you're not enjoying a book, put it down. There's that lightness of touch that pervades his work. I think also, when we're thinking about attention, the early modern world's quite a good place to, I know you're an expert in this period, Paul, but it's quite a good place to start, because they are grappling with an information overload of their own. Yeah. Suddenly, print media is making them all feel very confused.
Mm. There's a lot of fake news around.
Exactly. And Montaigne is himself responding to texts which were just recently made available. Mm. So a lot of classical learning was suddenly there to enjoy. And he's sort of saying, well, you know, this is good, this is not so good.
Well, they're working in a comparable environment of technological change, of cultural change, with the printing revolution, of course, and Protestantism. And we may be going through something like that now. I mean, there's a lot of scare stories about AI, which may well be somewhat supercharged, but there is no doubt that there is some kind of cultural revolution taking place at this place in time, and a shift in geopolitics perhaps as well, which that period informs our present.
Yeah, and so I'd just like to kind of go through how Montaigne actually tells us how to deal with attention, because it's something that comes back through the essays over and over again. How do I focus on the things that make me feel not just good, but make me better and better at doing things, better at relating to my family, less grouchy, everything. You know, these are things that we constantly thinking about. And he very much criticizes the kind of neo-Stoic view, where he says, he refers to Seneca and Cicero and the rest and says, you know, they're always telling us to be more present. But he says, that's fine as far as it goes. I like to pay more attention to the present. I don't want to be overridden by fears of death, fears of the future. I want to master those fears. I want to focus on the needs of the day. But he also acknowledges that human beings are a bit tricky. They can't just say, I'm going to be more present today, because they've got imagination. We're constantly making assessments about what is going to happen in an hour's time.
Anxieties about the future.
Completely. So he's very humane and gentle and says, you know, there's a kind of natural aberration that we have. We're constantly imagining what things would be like otherwise. He says we are never at home. We're always outside ourselves. One of the wonderful sort of bon mots that's threaded through the essays. Mm. You know, fear, this is another quote, fear, desire, hope impel us towards the future.
Yep.
And they rob us of feelings of concern for what now is. And he's saying, you know, we don't want to be robbed of feelings of concern, but we also need to recognise it's going to be a bit more complicated than just saying pay attention to the present. So how does he then develop this argument over his essays? He talks about how we have certain images inside ourselves. He talks about this kind of interior blankness that I referenced with the smartphone. I feel a lot of people, when they look at their smartphone, are conscious of some lack.
Yeah.
They are conscious that nothing is really going on in there, so they want to compensate. What does Montaigne say about that little kind of motivation? He says, when shaken and disturbed, the soul needs something to grasp onto. We must always provide it with an object to butt up against and to act upon. Plutarch says of those who dote over pet monkeys or little dogs that the faculty of loving, which is in all of us, rather than remaining useless, forges a false and frivolous object for want of a legitimate one. And if you ever spend time in a park in London, you'll see that many people are investing in having dogs rather than doing other stuff. So what he's saying there is that, again, our imaginations need stuff to feed on. You know, we sort of need to feed the beast. So we're always getting outside ourselves. We're always saying that this image in here, whether it's the image of love or image of what our job is like, constantly wants to find itself out there somewhere else. And we spend enormous amounts of time trying to match them up. It's interesting that Carl Jung, the 20th century analytical psychologist, also talks a lot about this problem of internal images which don't match up with our experience in the real world, and then we forge very, very powerful forms of compensation. But this is just a basic human impulse. It's like we all do that, and it's actually really adaptive. How else do we say the present's not great, so I'm going to take a hugely risky business gamble in order to make the future better? You must have some internal picture of what that future looks like in order to take the risk. Why build a cathedral when you've got a, you know, we could just build a church and it have enough capacity? Why do we make sacrifices all the time in the present to achieve a future goal?
And something and that, beyond ourselves.
Yeah, and so Montaigne's sort of saying, well, we can be present, that's good, that probably helps us get through the day, but nature also tells us to get on with it, to go out there, play sport, fall in love, business, tell stories, and to kind of live the human comedy, which I think a lot of people are sort of quietly resisting in a funny way, even as they're trying to relate to the world through their smartphone. And it's a maladapted form of a basic human impulse. We all want to relate to the world. And the smartphone is the latest and most flashy, lovely tool which allows us to relate to the world. Mm. But for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to be producing the kind of positive downward consequences that, say, investing in developing taste in classical music, or reading powerful novels did. So why is that? And I think that I again, in the essay, returned to early modern culture, because there's sort of other authors who are also grappling with this problem. Miguel de Cervantes is, apologies for my crap Spanish pronunciation, in Don Quixote, that's kind of the first really obvious novel. I mean, you read it and you think, I'm reading a novel rather than, say, a kind of picaresque sequence of scenes, which is what you'd get in, say, Rabelais. It's just sort of one scene after another. There's no real plot. In fact, the way Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel is threaded together is almost so simple as to defy imagination for a modern piece of literature. But Don Quixote is not like that. It's very self-conscious. There is a kind of a total feeling you get reading Don Quixote that threads itself from the beginning to the end, even though it's 1,000 pages long. There's a recognisable tone that pervades the whole thing.
And it manages to be very sad and very funny.
Yes, very sad, very funny. And there's that lightness of touch all the time, which gives, I think that's the brilliance of the novel form, is that it allowed us to mix comedy and tragedy in new and innovative ways. And we're still living with this kind of beautiful, people always recognise that when they see it, even in television.
Television at its very best. Yeah, is that when we think about The Wire or The Sopranos or Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, that sort of stuff. Patrick Melrose, I was thinking of, you know, this stuff. Well, we know that stuff like The Wire has a novelistic quality, and searches, you know, it's very much engaged with that, in the fact that the late 20th, early 21st century TV series, long extended TV series, is perhaps the equivalent, our equivalent, of the 19th century novel. And of course, there are so few of them that are actually good, or rather, there are so few of them that really will be considered great. I think we can see what some of them are. The Wire certainly is one.
Yeah. And The Wire is very funny.
And it's also very rich in language, which I think is really interesting about The Wire. Visually, it's terrific, of course, but its central form is language. It almost creates a world of language, which is really quite remarkable. And it deals with the big things. And, of course, it's terribly violent. It is very, very sad. But it is also strikingly funny in terms of its black comedy. It is extraordinary.
And there's constant tragic storylines where people are struggling against circumstances not of their own creation.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of
and taking story at the heart of risk. It.
Yeah, you know, taking risk that then about. Embroils you in new problems. So, as you were saying, Paul, creating a world. So Don Quixote is all about creating a world, and at its heart is Don Quixote, who's this extraordinary Falstaffian kind of character. He's goes out in search of adventures. Why does he go out in search of adventures? He's been reading loads. So there's this brilliant bit at the beginning of the whole novel. And actually, the novel as a whole is a kind of tutoring in culture of Don Quixote. Over the whole course of the novel, he changes. And that's, again, a kind of nice story for us if we're talking about what great literature does to you. It does change you in a way that you might not realise at the time. So Don Quixote, he's obsessed with these chansons de geste romance stories, these adventure stories about the knight errantry, it's kind of Arthurian tales, Tristan and Isolde, all that stuff that we all remember from our childhood, actually. You know, these simple stories that are also completely absurd, that feature jewels and dragons and dwarves and giants.
Sounds like Game of Thrones.
Modern fantasy, I think, owes quite a lot to this kind of mishmash jumble of sensory overload.
For better or worse.
Yeah, so Don Quixote, he's completely obsessed with these books of chivalry. So he's paying complete... His attention is completely absorbed by the books. He spends days reading them. So you can't say that Don Quixote is not focused. He's got a lot of focus. And I think that's the same with us and our smartphones. You can't say we're not paying attention to something, because we are. We're spending about 6 hours a day on them all the time.
There probably wasn't that much to do on the flat plains of Castile in the 16th century. So, it's fair to say.
So what was Don Quixote do to compensate for not having much to do? He's a sort of poor gentleman farmer.
He's a fantasist.
Yeah, he fantasizes. These books are just brilliant fantasies for him. And Cervantes is sort of quietly... There's a lot of discussion in the novel about what makes a good or bad book. Mm. And he clearly is really pissed off with the reading public. But there's this brilliant exchange about halfway through the novel between two of the characters about who you should blame because people read bad stuff, which is such a classic modern problem. Yeah. Like, why do people want to watch trash? And Cervantes, through one of his characters, and I think this is his authentic voice really, says, oh, you can't really blame the public because they're just looking at what's out there. You've got to blame the people who are producing this stuff. Mm. And the temptation for the people producing this stuff is always to go for the lowest common denominator because of the false idea that instant popularity will equal commercial success. Mm. And that's the incentive, he says. But Cervantes says, no, you'll actually make more money in the long term if you produce good stuff. And he draws on various examples from some of the great playwrights of his time who produced genuinely great drama. You'll make more money in the long term. It might be a slow burner. Mm. And actually, the public will thank you even more for it because they'll still enjoy the stories. There's still that basic impulse.
And this reminds me of a recent FT column by Jan Ganesh, who's usually a very interesting character. It's one I completely agree with, is that highbrow culture... That's great. Lowbrow culture, that's great. I love the sort of indulgent kind of T.S. Eliot, George Orwellian revel in what would be seen as rather the lower forms of the arts. I love Viz comic, for example, and rather crude comedy. That's all very good. What I can't really stand and what has no appeal is the middle brow. And I think that seems to be the dominant factor at the moment of middle brow, that we're not really willing to judge things that aspire to a sort of competence and aspire to greatness even. But you sort of sit there thinking, is this really any good? Is this really quite as good as people say? I mean, Ganesh quotes things like Succession. Is Succession really comparable to The Wire or The Sopranos? Maybe not.
And as a work of art, it isn't, because it doesn't have the creative tension at its heart The Wire does. It doesn't sustain.
I found it quite disappointing, I have to say. I mean, I think they did so much better with Peep Show, which might be at the lower end of things, but those authors. But I think there is a problem there, and I think this comes back to one of the things that we talk about again and again is the real virtue that's lacking in our culture, which is courage. It's the courage to make judgments and not to go with the flow and to say, is this really as good as you think it is? And to say, this really is brilliant. And to make that judge between what is great, what is good, what is competent, and what is bad. And we've lost that ability because we're so concerned about offending, about whether we might fall to those who are offended by us, that we're so unwilling to judge. And it's really, really damaging aesthetics, where it's judging that one building is better than the other, that one piece of music is better than the other, that one work of literature is better than the other. We've got to go back to that really strong critical impulse to say, this is good, this is not. That seems to be to a profound problem in Western society, of really being willing to say what is good and define what is good or great.
And a major concern in Cervantes is this idea that a kind of cultured consciousness, which is untutored, which is not regulated by taste, by a kind of sense of style, by a kind of broader view of life, is actually really bad for human beings. Thinking that you know enough that you can go and do things without those kind of regulating factors, that kind of attention to detail, the kind of systematic reading that accompanies, not just reading, but anything, just sort of systematically going back to knowledge that kind of upsets your, kind of just like softens your perceptions of things, reworks them. That can produce terrible results. Don Quixote's whole problem is going out into the world and looking for adventures. But the thing is, he finds something quite different. And then he comes to be tutored by experience, by his friendship with his great squire. It's almost, the reading has to stop. We have to get out there. Then you have to go back to the reading. That's the kind of thing that, that Cervantes is exploring. And it's what sets the tone for everything else and what becomes our literary culture, which is people who are very interested in doing stuff, but also see that we have to make time to sit in quiet, silently, with things that improve the kind of patterns working through our brains. And only then can we then actually find out what it's like to live a bit of a fuller life. And that journey may take you to incredibly unexpected places. It might not actually meet your assumptions of what you thought it was going to be. And that's potentially scary. It potentially that's produces anxiety.
That's the joy of life, is having your ideas transformed. And there's a great unwillingness to really enjoy that change, that transition, that challenge to your perceptions and to develop in a way. It always strikes me as though there's a virtue, people say, in maintaining your political views, in maintaining your culture views. Complete nonsense. What a terrible thing to do with your life, to remain the same for 70, 80, 90 years. What an appalling prospect that is. And that development depends on an engagement with culture, which we should develop and take every opportunity to develop. And challenge ourselves, ultimately. That is the point.
And it should be fun, just to... I think there is that kind of basic impulse to tell stories. I mean, the novel, even... Yeah. I mean, again, just come back to Don Quixote. I'm probably boring the listener here, but Don Quixote, people say, oh, it's tedious at times. Yeah, some bits are tedious.
Like
but
life.
It's like a test match. You sit through the boring stuff in order to get that over, which changes your whole view of what's possible. Physically, emotionally, you know, I was at an extremely brilliant performance of Mahler's Second Symphony on Saturday night, actually in a car park in Peckham, which shows that, you know, it's actually a brilliant setting for a piece which is about reinvention, in a way.
Peckham, for those who don't know, is in South London.
Yeah, it's in South East London. And the person next to me was repeatedly throughout the performance filming what was happening. And I kind of wanted to turn to her and be like, it's just an orchestra in a car park. Surely you can take a photo and that'll be that. But she was filming it. Okay, fine. She's then spent the last 15 minutes of the symphony just like going through WhatsApp messages and emails. And I just closed my eyes and thought, I'm not going to... This is just weird.
But just concentrate. Just, mate, show some respect.
There's only 15 minutes left. Yeah, and that 15 minutes is going to blow your mind. Yeah, it's like incredible. It's an extraordinary... The whole thing depends on you being there for the last 15 minutes in that piece, because it is about the reinvention of everything that came before.
Maybe great work's wasted on some people. Well, anyway.
I just thought it was such a funny little case.
No, it's bizarre.
It's
I've seen
the most
it before,
magical
but
music.
Not often. Not often.
Anyway,
thank you for that survey, Alistair. I'm not quite sure what our advice is, other than to buy a pair of noise-cancelling headphones, subscribe to Audible, and get onto the Engelsberg Ideas newsletter. But that's sound enough advice as it is. And to explore culture, that's the key point. And don't think anything is beyond you, and concentrate on the canon. We need to sustain the canon. We need to relish the canon because it is proven, it is tested by time, and things persist for a reason. So let's engage with that. Thank you, Alistair. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.